Unified with Momobo Ogoro. This is News Talk.
This is a show where we listen, laugh, and learn. And as we meet people from different backgrounds, we ultimately ask ourselves the question, how can we unify across our differences? My name is Momobo Ogoro, your host, and you can get in touch with us by emailing unified@newstalk.com. That's unified with a Y-O-U. Coming up on today's show, we'll be discussing with our panel the reality of racism in Ireland. We'll meet a man who's lived experience of the international protection system and how he's inspired to pursue studies in law while also advocating for disability rights. And we'll hear about the gaming convention that's taking place in Belfast, welcoming those who are neurodiverse. But first, the topic of racism, race in Ireland, is something that is highly contentious and a difficult conversation to talk about. And specifically for the last couple of years, especially from 2020, the topic of racism has been a conversation that we as a society are growing in our understanding, in our learning and understanding of ourselves, our communities, and more widely as well with a national action plan against racism. So today I wanted to discuss the realities of racism in Ireland, what it actually looks like, what we can actually do, and how we can actually move forward in unity as a society across racial differences. Now, today we're going to be joined by two people who have spent years working, researching, and advocating in the space of anti-racism in Ireland. Buki Adebowale, Policy Education Officer at the Irish Network Against Racism in Ireland, and also Dr. Eben Joseph, who's the CEO of the Institute of Anti-Racism and Black Studies, and also Ireland's Special Rapporteur of Racial Equality and Racism. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
So I want to start off with Dr. Eben. When it comes to the reality of racism in the context of 2020 in Ireland, where are we?
2026. I was like, okay, we're going back to George Floyd.
In my brain.
I think, but that's probably what's in the back of your mind. Because that was the trigger, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, I think, okay, so for me, it feels like a sad moment when I look at the issue of race and racism in 2026, like just sitting here now. I came in here with a bit of a heaviness, you know, and it was just because I was thinking, oh my God, we've regressed, we've gone back, you know. I mean, 2020 was a pivotal moment for all of us, you know, when it comes to the issue of race. Yes, it was a loss of somebody, you know, it was a loss of life, but it meant the whole world came together. We all agreed. We all saw the fact, you know, it was visible. There was, for once, I thought the whole world came together and agreed that racism was an issue, you know, and we were all willing to do something about it, you know, and that has been, you know, progressing. But in the last, you know, 1 year, it's just like we've just pulled back everything. You know, why we challenge critical race theory a lot? If you read that theory, it actually talks about that, you know, and that this incremental, that these increases that we see, what happens is that in a little while, it just gets pulled back. They all get pulled back, you know. So it's not, because if we've been increasing exponentially, like, you know, all the time, you know, all these years from the 50s to the 60s to now, then we would have been far gone. So why are we still here? That's because we take 3 steps forward, then we go back 4.
And where
we take 5 steps forward and we take 6 steps back.
Where do you think that regression is coming from? Do you believe?
I just think that, you know, so because I'm an educator, I think that, you know, we've not done the deeper work of re-educating. And this is how I get trolled a lot, because I keep going back to education. But we are a nation of scholars. And the only way we've been able to learn to be where we are as a nation is that we've unlearned things. We've always appealed to education. When it comes to, think about it, everything we've changed in Ireland, we've taken it back to the schools. We've taken it back to our education system. The only thing we're refusing to take back to education system is this issue of racism. Mm. We have to go back there. We have to unlearn. You know, so it's like, you know, I do this thing when I talk about like a tree, you know, you put a plaster on a tree, you know. So what we're doing with racism everywhere is that we're putting a plaster on a tree. We need to go to the root. What is the root? The root is that we think some people are inferior. Mm. That is it. We think we're superior to a group of people. We think they should be grateful and they are fortunate to have these opportunities that they have. That is the crux. That's what racism is about. It's not that I don't like the shape of your head or I don't like the clothes you're wearing. It's not about all of those things. It's that this group of people are inferior to this. So if you want to address racism, you need to go to that route, unlearn that, change that. And how do we do that? We have to re-educate.
And that's a difficult one, trying to get into the education system to talk about these sort of areas of work. And I know, Buki, your work is in specifically talking about anti-racism and the Irish Network Against Racism. Can you let us know how you actually, your day-to-day, what you actually do to ensure that we can become an anti-racist society?
Well, to start off, I would say that a core piece of the work that we do at the Irish Network Against Racism is focusing on that systemic issue. Dr. Ebon alluded to the fact that we're looking at tackling something at the root. And in INR, what we try to do is we try to take the voices of our network, take the voices of our community on the ground and translate that in a policy perspective and also speak to the issue of systemic racism and really hone that in. Because what we see with racism is that people often attribute it to individual or interpersonal kind of interactions with people, but it goes way beyond that. It's a historic issue and it focuses on power imbalances. And that is what is manifesting in our structures. So socially speaking, what we see in society today and how people create these cultural norms, and then also talking about institutional racism as well and looking at how our institutions perpetuate these things. And so my work at INR and, you know, our team's work at INR is to really hone in on those deep systemic issues and bring them to light and tackle them from there, because that is what allows racism to manifest in an individual way. And I think that's a really big issue that needs to be addressed. And so we do that in the day-to-day kind of basis. And whether that's through submissions, whether that's through working with our community and co-creating and collaborating. And I think it's very critical for us to continuously center the voices that we're actually working with to make sure that it's not a removed conversation and we're just talking about people from a distance, if that makes sense.
And I think specifically when it comes to that work and centering those voices, it's hugely essential for it. And I know you, Dr. Ebon, you do a lot of work that and research that centers the voices of Black people of African descent. How does that research apply to the everyday work that you do in terms of education?
It does apply, because at the end of the day, you know, we use it for disability. We say nothing about us, you know, nothing, you know, for us, you know, without us, you know. So, and that's the key thing, because, you know, you are the one that actually knows what it feels like. I can do a Google search if you want, you know, but my experiences are not a Google search. You know, so it's really going to those places, you know, to those same people and getting those voices and including them. So we do that either by writing, you know, we do research around that. And, you know, they tell you their experiences. They tell you, when people actually tell you, this is how I experience it. You know, the Thomas Somers theorem says that, you know, if somebody says this is what they experience, then it is truth. You know, you might not see it, you know, but if that is their experience, then that is their truth. You know, so it's about, you know, giving those voices space, you know, to be able to, and it's such a healing process for people. Because one of the major things we find when we do this work on racism and anti-racism is that people feel a shut up experience, you know, so there's a pushback, there's a resistance, you know, when people talk about their experiences of racism, you know, particularly when people are trying to do the individual work, you know, to say, but maybe in their place of work, they have encounters of racism or, you know, in schools, you know, when they try to do that work alone, what they get, whether it's from teachers or whether it's from, you know, their employers, you know, it's usually a shut up experience. So one of the things we're finding now is that we're seeing that, you know, like in the places of work, when people actually report racism, you know, what they get is that it turns on them. And then it turns on them, and then they have to say, oh, you have to go through self-development, you have to go through management training. So it turns. So they become, they're the one now defending themselves when they have, you know, so it's a double thing. So in the work we do, we try to make sure that, you know, you have to, in storytelling, use storytelling to push those voices. Like I talk about counter storytelling, counter narrative, you know, and counter narrative is where there's a, if you look at in Ireland, we have some dominant narratives. So what are the dominant narratives? You can you see them there. They're online, they're available. So you, how do you get a counter narrative to that? Because it's not just constantly responding to what is there, but you produce the counter narrative to that story, you know, that is out there. And that begins to bring the shift and begin to shift the way people look at it.
And it's very, very telling and important to have those, and essentially that's why this show exists, to create that space for the voices. And I know, like you were saying, that racism as a system, as a system of power. And sometimes when that power is like let go, there's a lot of fear and hostility and loud voices come into the room. Sometimes that fear and hostility can breed, let's say, very difficult conversations that need to be had with people and even people listening to this show. And I want to ask you, Bookie, specifically, when it comes to those like loud voices, those voices that are changing, that are on social media, that are altering people's perspectives around certain communities, like what Dr. Eben was saying, as seeing them as less than. What should we be doing to support people that are like just seeing all of this content, seeing everything online, and reading things that are not favorable or racist, essentially?
Honestly, this is such a great point, because it's really easy for us to get really bogged down with the emotions that come about when we see these really horrible, horrible comments on social media. We've seen this happening with, you know, people who are in public life, specifically women as well. And I think something that has been really, really helpful is understanding and thinking strategically. First of all, I would say the first place to even start off is solidarity and community. It's so important that we have one another to rely on, and also that we can share burdens and share pains. And I think one thing that comes about from these narratives is divisiveness and division. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that we need to try and avoid. And so being able to share and being able to work in solidarity is a key thing. Another thing that I said was, which is working on being strategic in, I guess, directing our frustrations, is looking at what's at play underneath the surface. Again, we keep going back to this idea of putting a plaster on the tree, like Dr. Eben said, and when we're supposed to be tackling the root. I think it's important for people to realize what we need to be tackling, which is ultimately, you know, the social kind of, I guess, the social issues that we're seeing in Ireland today, and, you know, the structures that are in place that are working against us most of the time. And so being able to direct our attention to those things is key. And it's something that we do a lot in our work in policy, trying to make sure that all our resources and our efforts are working to change the system that is allowing for people to be able to make racist comments online. And that speaks to a bigger issue. It speaks to the failure of our policies. It speaks to the failure of our legislation. It speaks to the gaps in our legislation. And, you know, looking at incitement to hatred, how outdated our 1989 Act is, and how many, many bodies across even Europe and even, you know, supranational organizations like, you know, the United Nations calling for those gaps to be filled in those legislation. Those are really important, because they will filter out all those voices that come up online, because those spaces won't, I guess, fertilize and allow those things to fester and grow.
But what if it's people that are saying that, like, it's their opinion? Or it's how they feel about the situation, or it's their concern around, for example, immigration. How would you react to that?
Oh, you know what? Actually, again, I feel like Dr. Edwin and I are actually in sync with this, because I think, again, it goes back to this lack of education and understanding. It actually goes also back to the lack of understanding of the values that our nation is standing on, which is equality. Like, if we go as far back as 1916 proclamation, looking at the value of equality being the basis of what Ireland's supposed to be founded on, and understanding the history of Ireland and where they were as racialized people, and how, you know, that racialization can also cause them to be complicit. So educating people and understanding that where you're directing your energy is actually not, you know, it's not conducive to what you're trying to solve. It's not helpful. And it might be your opinion, but your opinion is really, really not based or rooted in any fact. And I think it's important that people understand that these opinions, they often come from a lack of education or a lack of understanding and a lack of awareness. And even not to stoop so far as allowing someone determine your reaction to the situation, and understanding that it's important that you come from an educated place as well. It's quite hard sometimes, but I think it is important. Yeah.
And that education really is not necessarily just learning about the systems, the policy, the things that are in place institutionally. It's a lot of personal education, like Dr. Eben was saying, in terms of unlearning, relearning. And I find that Dr. Eben, as you're in your work in the Anti-Racism Institute, like I imagine you would have a lot of people going through personal transformations, a lot of defensiveness. Can you speak on that?
Oh, yeah. Like I always say, just to say about, you know, I'll come back to this stuff, but just to say about, you know, like online hate, like, you know, I should be the queen of, if they, you know, you can crown me, you know, like the queen of racism. Okay, let me not give myself a name. It was like really vitriolic. You know, I think some of the key things, you know, like, so if somebody's, So maybe somebody's out there, you're an ally, you're wondering what you can do. So some people really helped me on those platforms, you know. So it was just, so they kind of minimize the, you know, the negative speakers. So that's what allies can do. Mm. Allies, if I keep quiet, you can't keep quiet, because then it will just be a page of, you know, bile on the page. But what people did was they posted up. So that was really good. So I had really good friends, or, you know, people who knew my work or people who knew about me who came out. That's what allies can do. Speak up, you know, in those spaces. And then I think for me personally was, you know, like, I just delete, you know. So if it's really, really bad, I just go, I group them 10, delete, you know, I get some people together, they go through, we just comb through around what is really, really bad, delete it, you know, particularly if they're attacking somebody else, or if we posted about somebody and so we delete. So that's, so use your paragraph. I really enjoy deleting.
I'm blocking.
Yeah, I'm blocking. I really enjoyed deleting and blocking. I'm like, no, it's my page. It's my prerogative. I'll use it. I'll delete and block you. I don't have to listen to you. So use that. So that's really, really good. Mm-hmm. And I think not to take those comments personally, really important not to take them personally. Now, you know, because if not, like I said in one of the, that it piles on, you know, the one you got last year, it doesn't go away. Then you got another one, you know, early this year. Then you got one today. So they pile on. So how do we heal that? How do we, you know, how do we on, you know, onboard? So just people minding themselves, you know. So but in over the years, I've learned, you know, when I do a lot of trainings, I use a lot of humor. Mm. You know, now I don't mince words. I say exactly what I need to say, but I use a lot of humor because it's kind of heavy. You know, it shouldn't be heavy, because we talk about suicide, we talk about death, we talk about cancer. Those are heavy, you know, yet we still talk about them. Do you understand? So we make it feel like racism is such a heavy thing. You know, so I use a lot of humor, but I never forget to, you know, the point still goes in. And I think I've learned that over the years. But it's usually quite transformational, you know, because people come in on one, you know, on one side. Like, you know, I talk about 5 stages that a white person needs to, oh God, they're going to throw me. But I talk about 5 stages a white person needs to go through before they can actually fully listen and hear about racism and not internalize it. Because when a white person hears it, it feels like, oh, you're talking to me, you're blaming me, you know. I always say that, girl, I can't unblack myself. You can't unwhite yourself. I didn't make me black. You didn't make you white. But, you know, we all inherited this space that we're in. Mm. So the question we're asking ourselves is, what can we do about this space we've inherited? So just the way like you inherit your grandma's house, you don't leave it the way it is. You change it. You change the foundations. So it's the same thing. We've inherited this. Racism was 500 years ago. We didn't start it. None of us alive today started it, but we've inherited it. But if we keep on allowing it to go on hinder, then we become complicit. We become just as guilty as the people who started it. So our job is to do something about it. And then that becomes like it becomes a pathway for people to begin to make steps to bring changes. Mm. And I think just one last thing is to say that rather than telling people that they are racist, you know, I usually say you've performed a racist act. So that was a racist act. What that does is separates the person from the act, and it gives people a room to navigate, to negotiate. There's always that 15% who will be racist. They are racist. They are proud racist. They wear it today. They wear it with a smile. It's their badge of honor. So you would always have that. But there's a 75%, you know, it's a bell curve. There's a 75% in between who are neither here nor there, who would do something that is racist and is to walk with people like that. So, you know, that was a racist act, you know.
And it's that separation of because a lot of people, when they hear that word racism or racist, alarm bells just like ring in their head. And it's like, no, I'm not racist. I'm not racist. I'm not racist. But that, like you said, it's just really detaching the behavior from their identity, because at the end of the day, people want to have a positive sense of self. So that's a really great thing in terms of like, okay, you may have said something that was perceived as racist, that was racist, but it was a behavior and you can learn from it and you can move forward from it. And specifically, that behavioral lens feeds into that sort of wider systemic and cultural lens. And from your work, Buki, can you actually tell us from that systemic cultural lens? We talked about education, but like what actually works from that systemic level? Is it integration services? Is it dialogue?
This is deep.
I want to know.
Oh, gosh. You know, I think one thing that I think is really beautiful to see is the power of people I think it's so underrated. I think it's so underestimated, the power of communities coming together. And we always talk about the issues that we see with racism on the ground, and all we see is the negative things. But I really want to actually push the narratives that are really positive, seeing initiatives being birthed out of such a horrible, you know, thing to happen to people. And I think that works. Oddly enough, it really works, especially on a community level, at a grassroots level. Another thing that works in theory, but maybe isn't manifesting practically, is, again, I have to keep going back to it because I'm a policy officer, but the policies that we have in place. I mean, Dr. Edwin is here. You can probably speak to the National Action Plan Against Racism. Plans like that should work if the words are, you know, attached to actions, if the words are attached to accountability. And unfortunately, we are not seeing them attached to those things. And they can work if they are attached to the actions. And so ultimately, I also think another thing that really, really is important is concrete enforcement of legislation, laws in place, like having laws in place that protect the people they say they serve. And the NAPBAR, you know, it focuses on making sure that our legislation is up to date to protect people who experience racism. Like, I mean, the first objective in the NAPBAR is being safe. That's the first thing. And our legislation is supposed to complement that safety. And, you know, again, there are so many gaps in legislation to the point that even though we have things in place that are written on paper, policy rich in Ireland, the actual thing that is happening on the ground is that people are experiencing the result of when these policies or these pieces of legislation aren't enforced. And I guess it's speaking to the other side of your question, which is that this should really be working, but it's not at the moment, practically speaking.
And can you tell us, thank you so much, Bookie. Dr. Evan, can you tell us, especially as the special rapporteur of race equality and racism, can you speak on Bookie's point as to like why it may not be working?
I think maybe if I start from the two things. One is that racism only functions. The reason racism continues is because of two things. One of them is power. Mm-hmm. Where is the power? Is the power dynamics. Racism would have been gone years ago if there was no power backing it. And the second thing is policy. So it's policy and power. Those are the only, not because I'm mean, no. Those things would have been gone. Mm-hmm. Right by now, racism would have withered down. But we keep using power. So the power system, there's a power structure that backs racism, that enforces racism. I always ask, which came first, race or racism? Mm-hmm. You know, it was racism. Racism is an idea. It's an ideology. You see, so racism is not just what you do. No, what you do is how we enforce the racist ideology. Do you understand? So, and this is why education is good. Education is not to just tell you, you know, this is race. No, it actually helps you to go back in your thought, to look at what is the pattern. So first thing is that racism came from an ideology, a thought pattern. And so that thought pattern, all the actions we take are to produce, are to enforce that thought pattern. Mm. So if I want to change the thought pattern, the actions I'm taking, what do? I need to change the thought pattern and I need to go. So those are the two things. So it's the policies. So the policies are enacted to perform that racist ideology in the mind. The policies are not just coming like, oh, we want to, you know. No, the policies are coming from that place. And then when we look at the National Action Plan, you know, we have it. I mean, in the report, I said, you know, one of the things is that we are so policy rich. My God, if you look at Ireland policy level, we're number one. Like it's like we have certificates in policy writing, you know, and we put policies we do, you know. But the lived experience, and that's what I did in the monitor in the first year report, was to talk about what organizations said the department said they were doing, and then to go to organizations to say on ground, what are you experiencing? And you looked at that, those things didn't match. The second key thing is that 7 of the departments did not write a report. So this is supposed to be a whole of government approach. So if 7 out of 18 didn't write, that is a fail. We as a nation, we need to use the NAPBAR. If there's one thing, and I'm going to try, because I was trying to talk to the department now to see, maybe just go around. That's not part of my role, but I'm willing to do it. Just go around the nation to try and, you know, just get people to be aware of using. We need to use the NAPBAR because it helps us to hold the government accountable.
And understanding that it's not just that lived individual experience of racism, it's institutional, and there are things out there that, like the National Action Plan Against Racism, to support. Well, folks, thank you so much for joining on the panel again. That is Bookie Adebowale, Policy Education Officer at the Irish Network Against Racism. Racism, and Dr. Ebun Joseph, who is the CEO of the Institute of Anti-Racism and Black Studies, and also Ireland's special repertoire on racial equality and racism. Now, if you want to share your thoughts, you can do so by dropping us a line on unified@newstalk.com. That's unified with a Y-O-U. Coming up after the break, we'll meet a man whose lived experience of the international protection system has drawn him to studying law and advocating for disability rights at Maynooth University. Stay with us. So for many people, conversations around migration, international protection and disability rights are often siloed or reduced to just headlines and political debate. But behind those conversations are real lives, real experiences and real voices. So our next guest knows that reality firsthand. That's Mohammed S. Camara, currently studying a Master's of Law at Maynooth University and focuses on migration, migrants and disability rights while advocating for this space. So tell us about your journey, Mohammed, as to how you got into the space of law and just advocating for this together.
Yeah, my journey has been an interesting and frustrating one because my life as a person with a disability started with some tragic incident that led me to flee my country of origin. I lost my mom due to the advocacy activities that I was undergoing in my country. And then I arrived there in Ireland with that philosophy that now that I'm in a white man country, things will be different and the situation will be far much more better than where I'm coming from. But I never knew about the system itself, the international protection system itself, and all what it entails until, like, I was into the system and then start facing the reality of these challenges. So some of these things, like, one, access to justice, wherein people with disabilities are required to have, like, specialized individuals that helps them to gain the required justice that they need. And Article 13 of the CRPD requires, like, for the state to provide training for these individuals that are handling these issues. But coming into the system, I find it difficult to understand these different areas. And with my story, because the international protection system itself, when an applicant provide a story, these applications are being assessed based on your story, your country of origin, and your vulnerability status. So looking at these different perspectives, I start wondering, why are people with disabilities so invisible? Every applicant story are being assessed on an individual basis. So all of these challenges and the difficulties, I was rejected once, twice, and all of these, like, pushed me to the wall. And then as an advocate, I wanted to understand what the law is really about when it comes to international. So that forced me to apply for my master's in international law and started my studies at the Maynooth University.
That's a full turnaround in terms of that personal experience in the international protection system and now advocating for others. And how did you navigate it, or how did you even feel as you were in that position when you were in that system?
The international protection, the 1951 convention looks at fear of persecution, threats to life and inhumane and derogatory treatment. So if you cannot, like, distinguish the vulnerability perspective of a disabled person, you cannot really fit this individual into this definition.
In terms of even that life and demystifying and debunking it in your advocacy work, what have you done to even support and demystify this kind of area with disability and international protection?
Well, some of the things we've been trying to do for example, personally, I've been engaging in all of some of the consultation being held by the National Disability Authority. Whenever there is a national consultation, I try to make sure I input my own perspective into this discussion and trying to create that kind of a visibility for persons with disability. And we are finding lots of challenges because, like, we're in a minority. There is not that much concentration for our category, especially those migrants with disability. So it's a really difficult situation, but we are trying our best. We also have a group that is formed within the branch of Mercy that we normally try to attend other invited occasions wherein we speak about these issues.
And I think it's something that that space that Mercy has created, it's a huge space for community, for connection, for even visibility, like you said. But I can speak for myself, like putting yourself out there, advocating for rights, advocating for justice can be quite challenging at times. Has it been challenging for you to put yourself in that space?
Very, very challenging, because like when you're looking at the trend of international protection system, it is very difficult to really focus on one intersectionality and like trying to bring my personal experience and the challenges you have to navigate within the system itself. You are fighting for yourself and you want to fight for others, and it's very difficult navigating these challenges physically and mentally. And of course there are other things like the system has created, and it's adding to your mental. All of these challenges, you have to navigate them individually and trying to advocate for others. Yeah, it's kind of like a double sword.
It's a double sword, like you said. And it's the not only the physical hurdle of going through the international protection system, but the mental hurdle of going through it, retelling your story. And in terms of how you cope with that emotionally, can you let us know how you cope with that? Are you coped, or are you still coping with it?
Yeah, it's a day-to-day stuff. And I want to extend my appreciation to the Maynooth University because they help provide some counseling services for me. And then I had a personal individual from the HSC who was also like providing some counseling service to me. But in a nutshell, it is difficult to really protect yourself from the mental hurdles, because when you're within the system creates these mental hurdles for you as well. And for example, one of the things I now develop is a PTSD to brown envelopes. Whenever I see brown envelope, I have PTSD. Mm. So it's an ongoing process and it's difficult. But yeah, I keep navigating through different means and ensuring that I prioritize my mental health as well.
And it's important, and particularly those who have gone through that international protection process, it's that re-traumatization and getting the adequate support to support their mental health and to have it in place, because it is a hard thing to go through, especially when you have, like you said, the intersecting identities as well. And I think what are your hopes for as you pursue this master's in law? What would you like in terms of like would you like a legal change, or what do you want to focus on?
Yeah, one of my focuses how to legally contribute and ensure the issue of disability is being properly defined within the international protection system. So as an advocate, I feel like it is the first step for me to go into law, understand the different perspective of the law, and so enhance my capacity within the law. And this will enable me within the advocacy field to be able to challenge some of the policies that have been drafted. And maybe from there, we see what will happen for those who will be coming in.
And I, it's a great sort of dream that you have, and specifically that understanding of the legal space and how that manifests into policy, how that manifests into everyday life and behavior, and particularly people's thoughts around the international protection system, folks who are seeking protection, those who are under danger, under threat, and the stories that are encompassing that. So what would you like to, like for the everyday person or Irish society, is there anything that you'd like them to better understand about the international protection system or people seeking asylum?
Yeah, to folks seeking international protection system, I feel the world is going through a very difficult moment. So we are never to lose hope. And to folks, Irish folks, I think there is a narrative of hate painting to the society. This is not a humanitarian obligation from the Irish society. The Irish people should look back to their history and understand that we are humans, we are not what they describe us, and we are not here to steal Ireland from the Irish people. Ireland will always be for everyone and its people that are living within the space. So I want to us as well, like, advocate to the government of making the voices of persons with disability visible within the international protection system and ensuring our safety and accessibility needs are being met within the system.
And that's a beautiful cause to actually back behind, ensuring safety, accessibility and a fair process for those who are in the international protection system. Thank you so much, Mohammed, for joining us on the show. Coming up on The Social Scene, we'll be talking about the initiative that has opened up the world of gaming to more neurodiverse people in Ireland. Stay with us. Welcome back to Unified. Now, from cosplay to consoles, gaming has become one of the biggest ways for young people and all people of all ages to connect. But for many people who are neurodivergent, these big events and social spaces can often feel overwhelming or exclusionary. But one convention in Belfast is changing all of that. FandomCon is Ireland's largest neurodivergent-led gaming convention, created by and for autistic neurodivergent people. And this weekend, more than 2,000 people are expected to join when the gates open. Joining us now to discuss this is Maeve Monahan, CEO of Now Group, the social enterprise behind FandomCon, and Chris Campbell, founder of FandomCon. Welcome to you both. Now, I know FandomCon is coming up and it is a mass of events this year, but can you tell us about the story, Chris, particularly of how it came about from a small group to a 2,000 person convention?
Really, how we did was we already had Fandom going, our social groups who run weekly for people who are autism who are over 18. And we had it going for about 8 years at that stage. It's getting more popular, we're making more groups, but you know, we want to show that the autistic community, there are groups out there to support them. Really, you have small social groups right there, maybe once a month they meet up. And we thought, well, we've made this group that's lasted about at the minute over 10 years old. Why don't we broadcast that to the public and say, if you are over 18, come here and we can support you. And that's what it's really for. So we gathered together people who are in fandom, who are all autistic, and said, right, if we want to do a convention to help advertise fandom, what would you do? And really, we just took the activities that the guys do and sort of made it bigger. So, for example, the guys love video games. So we took, like, outside vendor to host video game sessions. They have consoles, game PCs, and then brought them in together into the convention where people can come and try different games, regardless of what age they are.
That is a beautiful thing in terms of how the groups kind of came together and how the people that were neurodivergent came together, said that they needed the space and ultimately created it. And I know it's housed in the Now Group. Maeve, can you kind of explain what the Now Group does and how it collaborates with the convention to create this massive event?
Yes, well, NIGRIP is a registered charity and social enterprise that was born in Belfast but now operates across Ireland. And we support people with learning difficulties, autism, and those who are neurodivergent. And our focus is supporting people into jobs for the future. But some of the best work that we do is developing social groups and engagement groups to help people feel more comfortable and moving towards employment. So as Chris said, Fandom was the start of that as a social group based in Belfast. They grew because of the need for spaces for people to get together on a weekly basis across Northern Ireland. We're expanding that model wider than Northern Ireland now, but the conference really comes because everything NIGRIP does is co-designed, so designed for and by the people who are attending, and it's probably why it's so popular.
That's beautiful. And I think these sort of enterprise, social enterprise and non-profit organizations are hugely essential for supporting and equipping people and communities to do things for themselves, because that's ultimately how we create those spaces of true belonging. And I know the convention itself is that space for belonging for people and all people, but for specifically people who are neurodiverse. And Chris, can you let us know how, especially for the size of the event that you have, how do you design a space that caters to all different sort of neurodiversity?
Well, the good thing about us being based in NIGRIP is all of our staff are well-trained in dealing with neurodiverse conditions. So between their feedback and then from our participants themselves in the groups, we sort of went from there, right, do we make it lighten? How wide of the space do we make it? What is too crowded? What isn't? We have a dedicated quiet space where people with things become overwhelmed. And it was more just sort of, you can't obviously care for every different condition out there, but you can at least try and hit the big bits, like film with crowds, lighting, that kind of thing.
It's necessary to, and like you said, you can't do everything for everyone, but like you said, the big things in terms of lighting, in terms of sound, in terms of even smells and the sensitivities towards that, it's important to cater to those needs. And I suppose you said that the NIGRIP staff and those who are volunteering are trained and are equipped with operating what is known as a jam card. Maeve, can you explain what a jam card is?
Yeah, so Jam Card is an initiative that is part of NIGRIP, started about 10 years ago, and Jam, J-A-M, stands for Just a Minute, and it's a card or an app that people with an invisible disability can use to communicate to others that although they may not look like they have a disability or a condition, they need a moment of patience. And that card, just like Fandom and Fandom Con, was designed for and by people with disabilities. And it has had great success with over 210,000 Jam Card users now across the UK and Ireland, and 3,000 businesses who have trained their staff to be more inclusive and supportive of customers with invisible disabilities. So it'll feature really heavily on the day at Fandom Con, and all Jam Card users will be very welcome. And as Chris said, everybody who will be supporting on the day will be very well trained to support people to have a great fun day.
And that's super essential for people to be well equipped, to be trained how to use these initiatives such as the Jam Card to support people, especially who have invisible disabilities, to support people and give that people that extent of patience and care that is needed to ensure that they enjoy days such as Fandom. So specifically, Chris, yourself, I know there's going to be activities, there's going to be competitions, there's going to be just all sorts of cool things that are happening on the day. Can you explain to the listeners what sort of cool things are happening?
Probably the biggest one is the cosplay competition. That's probably the biggest thing every year we do. So we would have people dress up as like their favorite characters, say from Marvel or DC or anime or something like that, or just create their own characters. And we do a whole cosplay gala. So between juniors and seniors, where they can show off their creations, get scored, and if they're lucky, they'll win a prize at the end.
That's cool. And what is that prize, can I ask?
The prize is a trophy and then a gift card.
Oh, that's beautiful. And I imagine a lot of people, it's a space for them to really open up their sense of creativity, dress up as their favorite anime or their favorite comic book characters, and really be a space where they can actually be their true selves. And Chris, why are spaces like this so important for neurodivergent folk?
Because there aren't many out there, to be honest. I couldn't think of, I've been to a few conventions and I can't think of one I've advertised where it's specifically catered to people who are got a neurodiverse condition. most of them are just mainstream, to be honest.
And I suppose that you have, especially as a founder of this space, you've created something that was just a specific need and a need for folks that had these, for folks that who are not neurodivergent and need that space where they can express their full selves. And I know there are plans to expand and offer more events. Maeve, do you want to speak more about that or Chris specifically on what the plans are to expand this event as you go forward?
Yeah, well, I'll maybe take that part because the Belfast Fandom Con has taken us all by great surprise at the level of interest in it. So that will continue to grow, and we really want to welcome people from all over Ireland and further afield to that as it develops. But we're also hoping to mirror what we have done in Belfast and Dublin as well as we start to grow. And, you know, on the day and after the day, when you reflect on it, to hear from those attending and their families who just feel that they're so welcome and that this is something that they can get involved in to make friends, to have new experiences and just to have a laugh. You know, what's not to like about it? I think we just want to see more people having access to spaces and events like this where they understand that they're really, really valued and very, very welcome.
That's beautiful in terms of that expansion and creating a space and just replicating a space of joy, because a lot of us at the end of the day, we just need spaces where we can feel seen, heard and understood. And I know in terms of how people can connect or engage with the convention, what is sort of advice that you can give to parents or young adults who are neurodiverse that want to attend, that may be a bit hesitant into attending? Chris, what is some advice that you can give them?
Oh, that's a tough one because we're always so sold out every time, so we really see that, to be honest. Probably that it's a safe space, really. Regardless of condition you have or background, like, it's just everyone's very friendly, it's open. There's really no barriers there, to be honest, for people to come and see us. It's an open space for anybody to come down and enjoy.
And what I was hearing from you, Chris, is just come as you are. It's an open space and people can come and enjoy.
Yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful. And it's important for these sort of live spaces to, and other events as well, to really replicate kind of what you guys are doing. And Maeve, I'd love to ask you, what kind of advice would you give to even listeners that are even organizing events, want to be more inclusive in terms of neurodivergent users or people coming to their events? What advice would you give them there?
I think every business event space and event organizer has to realize that people who are neurodivergent are part of the population. They're part of everybody's customer base. So I think the more inclusive you make a venue and an event, the better it is for everybody who attends. I think sometimes people are just a little bit concerned and it's an add-on after the topic. But what we have decided, or what we have found, is the more inclusive an event is, the more people want to come.
Well, folks, that was Maeve Monahan from Now Group and Chris Campbell, who's the founder of Fandom Con, which is taking place this weekend. And that brings us to the end of today's episode of Unified, supported by Commissioner Mann. And catch us on podcast on the Go Loud app or every Sunday on News Talk at 8 p.m. Goodbye for now.